worshiping more than a year. This is better than bringing water for the husband, is better than worshiping for a year. And there is a characteristics, and there is something about the year as well. It says that the year is in a way that siyami nahariha wa qiyami layliha, that it is better than a year in which a person fasts in the days, like 365 days fasting and waking and worshipping the whole night, qiyami layliha. وَيَبْنِ اللَّهُ لَهَا بِكُلِّ شَرْبَةٍ تَسْقِي زَوْجَهَا مَدِينَةً فِي الْجَنَّةِ. And for every single time when she brings the water for the husband and it takes away the thirst, and he is obviously, because he's thirsty, that's why. And then when she brings this water, then Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala makes a city in the paradise for her, وَغَفَرَ لَهَا سِتِّينَ خَطِيئَةٍ, and he forgives 60, we can say like bad deeds or sins of her. وَالسَّلَامُ عَلَيْكُمْ وَرَحْمَةُ اللَّهِ وَبَرَكَةٌ. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
The EU's hypocrisy seems boundless. The European Union funds research involving Israeli regime's police, despite admitting that it may be used for spying purposes. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by David Cronin Ryder. This article is titled, EU admits teaming up with Israeli regime police enables mass surveillance. Stay tuned for more. The European Union funds research involving Israeli regime's police, despite admitting that it may be used for spying purposes. Over the past few years, a project named Roxanne has been examining how criminals can be identified with the aid of speech recognition technology and visual analysis. Material intended for public consumption presents the EU finance project costing $8 million as benign. However, serious ethical issues have been raised when it was discussed behind closed doors. Internal EU documents obtained under Freedom of Information rules confirm there is a risk that Roxanne's results will be used for mass surveillance. An ethics check on the project conducted during 2020 refers to plans that personal data will be shared between the EU and the Zionist regime. The data collected during the project will incorporate special categories such as details on the genetic traits, health, lifestyle, political opinion, religious or philosophical conviction of individuals, according to that paper. The surrounding questions have become even more pertinent since the ethics check was carried out. painstaking investigations by human rights groups proved last year that the Zionist regime's Pegasus spyware is being used more widely than was previously known to monitor campaigners and journalists in various countries. The Zionist regime's police and its public security ministry are among the participants in Roxane. A condition of their involvement is that all data they export to the EU should be collected lawfully. Providing assurances of legal behavior is apparently deemed sufficient for the purposes of EU ethics checks to demonstrate that privacy issues are being treated seriously. In the real world, an Israeli assurance is completely worthless. The Zionist regime's police are seeking new powers that would allow greater surveillance without requiring warrants. A key proposal is that cameras in public places could be used to match people's faces with details found on police databases. Such a recommendation should, in itself, disqualify the Zionist regime's police from Roxane, which pays lip service to the principle of privacy awareness. There are, of course, numerous other reasons why the Zionist regime's police should not be benefiting from EU science grants. One major reason is that the Zionist regime's police are institutionally racist. A recent Human Rights Watch report on Lid, a city within the occupied Palestinian territories, also known as Lod, contains a vivid example of police racism. The report describes how police fired tear gas and stun grenades at a protest by Palestinian citizens of occupied territories in Lid last May. Yet, in some cases, when Jewish extremists attacked Palestinians in the same city that month, the police either stood by or failed to protect Palestinians from harm. The Zionist regime's police and public security ministry both have their headquarters in East Al-Quds, which has been under military occupation since 1967. Doing business with them should, by definition, be off-limits for the European Union, which is nominally committed to avoiding action that would lend the capture and colonization of East Al-Quds any legitimacy. There are strong indications that the Zionist regime has not been entirely candid with administrators in Brussels. Documents for Roxane Project give an address inside the occupied territories as the official contact for the public security ministry. If Brussels officials consulted the ministry's website, they would learn that its main offices can be actually found on Clermont's Gano Street in East Al-Quds. The involvement of the Zionist regime's police and public security ministry in Roxane and another EU-funded project called Law Train has sparked protests from the Palestine Solidarity Movement. More protest is needed. The Zionist regime's police and its public security ministry have been admitted into at least 8 other projects under Horizon 2020, the EU's current research fund. Among them are 2 border surveillance initiatives, Andromeda and Safe Shore. As border surveillance has become synonymous with cruelty toward refugees, questions must be asked about the precise role being played by the Zionist regime's racist police. A particularly troubling aspect of all this cooperation is that boasts made by the Zionist regime police are seemingly taken at face value. An EU-funded project called Shuttle is building a database of blood, gunshot residues, hair, and saliva. The Zionist regime's police force is taking part and will contribute its experience as a forensic expert and technological leader, according to Shuttle website. There is no acknowledgement that the Zionist regime is actually an expert in operation. By awarding research grants to the Zionist regime police, the EU is rewarding a force that detains Palestinian children, terrifies entire families by invading their homes, and opens fire on worshippers in Al-Quds Al-Aqsa Mosque. The EU's hypocrisy seems boundless. Shortly before Hisham Abu Hawash ended his hunger strike earlier this week, EU diplomats proclaimed themselves seriously concerned about his health. The diplomats were not concerned enough to demand that the EU stop cooperating with the Zionist regime's public security ministry, the regime's department overseeing the prisons where Abu Hawash and many other Palestinians are locked up without charge or trial. In December, an agreement was signed so that the Zionist regime can benefit from the EU's next research fund. Named Horizon Europe, the fund has an overall budget of approximately $110 billion. Predictably, the EU promoted the new agreement by celebrating how its cooperation with the Zionist regime has supposedly brought great advancements in medicine and environmental protection. Just as predictably, there was no mention that the cooperation is a cash cow for the Zionist regime's racist police.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Start.
Movement.
Speak.
Live in hope.
Toward the pit.
On Youth Station.
Islam Mahdi, Islam Mahdi. Allah my Lord, Allah my Lord. His word Quran, His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet, Muhammad Prophet. Praise be upon, praise be upon. I am Muslim for all of time.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salamun alaikum, dear listeners. I would like to invite you to IRIB English Radio, and this is Youth Station.
Salamun alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear listeners. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon you all. Salam Sayyid Jafar.
Alaikum salam. How are you, Hassanain?
I'm good. By the way, dear listeners, I'm Hassanain from India.
I'm Jafar Sayed from Houston, Texas. So on today's program, we would like to talk about just silence in general and when and in what situations is it accepted and recommended to be silent? In what areas it's not recommended to be silent? Yeah. What places is it allowed? Is it recommended to be silent?
Maybe when you see the dignity of a mu'min is being protected by your silence,
okay,
in that place it is recommended to be silent.
Okay.
But so if you see that, you have, again, you have to look at the consequences, right? Like, what happens if you're silent at that situation, and what happens if you speak at that situation?
Okay. So you're saying you have to look a little into the future and see what...
Yeah.
What, like, can transpire from your scenario, silence.
Yeah, what scenario it is, and what could be its consequences. When you feel that, by remaining silent, the particular person's, that moment's dignity is saved, you should be silent over there. For example, someone did something wrong. You just simply don't have to tell, like, oh, I have to do Nahya's Munkar, I have to stop him from doing wrong. And you just simply shout in front of everyone. You're disrespecting him. Now, what you can do is you can take him to a separate place and you can explain it to him.
What if you don't have the time to, say, take him to the side and say something? You're forced to, say, talk into a crowd. I'm not going to say it's a really big crowd, but it's not like 10, 12 people either. There's a good amount of people there. Like, what would you say to the person?
You have to measure the parameters. Like, for example, let me give you a situation where you don't have a chance to meet him later on and clear him and correct him. For example, someone is preaching something.
Okay.
You observe that, you know, he's preaching something wrong. And all his students are learning something wrong.
Okay.
Now, you don't have a chance to take the teacher to side some time after. Then what you do is, you know its consequence. Now, if you don't correct the teacher, what will happen? All his students will learn something wrong. Now, what you do over here is, you stop him right over and correct him.
Like, just right there, because, in the middle of, say,
exactly,
whatever.
Because
he's presenting
over here, you have to measure what's important and what's more important.
Uh-huh. Okay.
One place, it might be saving someone's dignity. The other place, you know, you're saving
everyone's
number
dignity
of students, yeah, from learning something wrong or being misguided.
Okay.
Over here, what you do is you stop them right over.
Okay. So the examples you're giving right now are times where you shouldn't be silent, right? Where you have to take action here, right? You're saying,
yeah,
you know, someone's dignity is at...
Both the examples, right?
Yeah, so
when you have to be silent.
So the first one, you were saying that, look, you're standing up for someone's dignity, right? Mm-hmm. The other one, you're saying that, suppose you're in a class,
yeah,
and the teacher is teaching in a way where, I don't want to say you're just, like, blatantly misguiding them,
mm-hmm,
but you're warping their way of thinking,
mm-hmm,
into a form that you don't want happening to, say, the city or a country, right?
Yeah.
Or just in a group of people in general. You gave these examples for situations where you got to step up,
mm-hmm,
you know, and not let this get out of hand.
Yeah.
What are situations where you shouldn't say anything?
Mm-hmm.
You just stand your ground, you see it happening.
Mm-hmm.
We will take a short break right now, and afterwards, we will get this answer from Hassanain.
This is IRIB English Radio. You are listening to Youth Station.
We are back, and I want to ask Hassanain, what situation should you be silent?
When you don't know, you should not speak. You should be silent at that moment. You just simply come and you just say something randomly. You can worsen up the things.
Uh-huh.
First, get to know about the situations. First, get to know what's right and what's wrong.
So you're saying don't react immediately.
Yeah. First, get to know about the things.
Read the situation.
Yeah.
You gave an example of, say, a teacher misguiding his students or giving the wrong opinion to his students.
Yeah.
And you stop him midway and tell him, look, this isn't right. You shouldn't be doing it this way.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They're going to go off of what you're teaching them.
Yeah.
You have a certain opinion on it.
Yeah.
And then you see its effect on the people around you.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But that initial opinion is yours.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it be right or wrong.
Yeah.
Right? You have a
But that's the most important thing, right? Nah, that's the most important thing. Your opinion doesn't matter. You like burger, I like pizza.
Okay.
That's a different thing. These are our personal opinions. But what matters is it right or wrong?
Okay. But everyone has their own personal preference towards it being right or wrong. Say, a third party person comes in, right? You like pizza, I like burgers.
Mm-hmm.
He comes in and he likes burgers too. He goes up to me and he says, look, you know, your idea is wrong. It's not correct. You know, I believe burgers are better, right? Something like that. Again, he's going based off of his personal opinion first, right?
Mm-hmm.
Say, because right now we're only three people. Now, you bring in 50 people, obviously he's not going to go to each person and say this. But he's going to say it out to everyone.
If I give an Islamic example, when someone is talking about halal and haram, like things about being permissible and not permissible, if someone says that, you know, weed is halal, whereas you know it's haram. Now, you know that he's preaching.
He's trying to get his idea out to the people. He wants other people to think the way he's thinking.
Exactly. But over here, his opinion doesn't matter. Over here, it matters whether he's right or wrong.
Okay.
Now, when he says that, he's preaching that, all the ones who are listening to him, they're being misguided.
Okay.
It's wajib upon you. It's compulsory and it's mandatory on you to correct him. You have to break your silence. You simply can't be quiet over here.
Okay.
Just break your silence and guide the people.
Okay, dear listeners, we have a concept in the West, and maybe in other countries of the world as well, that if you're silent, that means you've given your consent. You agree to this, right? So, Hassane, I want to get your opinion on this. Do you think this is correct in every situation?
Believing the silence is consent?
Yeah. As in, if you don't say anything, that means you agree with it. You're okay with whatever is happening.
There are different perspectives, right? Like how you look at it, how you look at the silence. Some people assume the silence to be consent.
Okay. The idea in the West is if you don't, suppose someone asks you a question.
No, in fact, it's the same thing in the East.
Okay, so that means it's a concept both in the East and the West.
Yeah.
That, look, you don't say anything, that means you're okay with it.
Okay.
But is this idea right in every situation?
If your wife asks you something and you're silent.
Why is he hitting me with the hard ones now?
If your wife asks you something and you remain silent.
Okay.
What does it mean?
It depends on how you're silent.
What does it mean? Tell me.
No, but that's what I'm saying. It depends on your body language when you're silent, right? I'm not going to say, oh, look, if you're silent every time, it means yes or no. It depends on how you're silent, right? The body language that you're giving off. In some situations, it means, yeah, I agree with you. In other situations, you're like, are you serious?
To understand this better, first we have to look, why do the people remain silent?
Okay.
For example, when your wife asks you something and you remain silent, it means that you don't clearly want to grant the permission. Or you just clearly, because you feel that that particular thing that your wife is asking for might not be good for her.
Okay. Yeah, I agree with that.
Then again,
that's one way of looking at it.
And you don't clearly want to reject your wife so that she doesn't feel you're getting bossy over her.
All right.
So here, you remain silent.
When I say silent means consent, someone rebuts you. Mm-hmm. They ask you a question where you have to give them a reason why they are wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And you say nothing there. Right? That's where the saying came from. Say, I ask you, well, is there anything wrong with eating burgers? You don't give me a response on that.
What I'm saying is right then. Yeah.
Right? Someone asks you that question, right? Now, if they're asking something and they want a yes or no answer and you give nothing, that's right. You could be looking at how that answer could affect them.
That's the idea of the whole thing, man. That's the idea of the whole thing. When you're not sure about something, you look at both the consequences. You just don't want to give a clear answer. You remain silent. You leave the job on the person who is asking you the question. You leave the job on them.
Okay.
And you let them decide whatever they want to do. Which is like, you know, which basically means you don't have, it won't create a big problem.
Yeah.
if it's a yes or a no. They can do anything. You'll have the choice with them.
An open-ended response, in a sense.
Exactly.
If someone wants, say, the negative aspect mm-hmm. of a certain topic,
uh-huh.
and they ask you and you say nothing,
mm-hmm.
that gives off the meaning that, look, you're okay with it. That means mm-hmm. there's nothing wrong with it,
mm-hmm.
right? A lot of questions are asked that way as well nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
Or, look, so what's your issue with this? And no one says anything. He's like, well, I didn't hear a no.
Mm-hmm.
That means you're all okay with this,
mm-hmm.
right? Now, is that the right, say, assumption we should take from that?
Not always.
Okay.
Not always. Because, you know, if you look at from the perspective of religion, look, there are two types of questions, right? When sometimes you're asking a question and its answer is simply yes or no.
Okay.
So that's like, it's like more like seeking a permission.
Okay.
You're seeking a permission. Should I do this or not? Am I allowed to do this or not?
Okay.
The answer might be yes or no. And the other questions, you're asking about something. You don't know about something, you're asking about it. Like, what's your opinion on this? The person you're asking the question, sometimes he's not sure about the topic. What he does is he remains silent. Or he simply says that, I don't know about it. What happens is, the guy who's asking the question, he gets really confused. Now he's perplexed. You know, it happens sometimes. Like, let me give you an example. If a guy asks his father, he likes some girl, he asks his father, Father, do you grant me permission to get married with this so-and-so girl? Now, over here, his father remains silent. Now, this really fets up the guy because his father is not answering.
Hussain, is this a personal experience that you're telling me about?
I've seen this more often, right?
Okay.
So, you know what I say? You know, the father should be, they should have a clear opinion over here, man. So, they should just tell their son, like, okay, it's not your age to get married. That girl might not be good for you. You might get some other good people.
But realize this goes back to the statement you said earlier, right? By not saying anything,
mm-hmm.
you're not hurting the person either, right? So now suppose you go up to your dad and you're like, Dad, you know, I like this girl. I want to get married to her. Like, you ask him, so should I do it? And he doesn't give you a response. There are two mm-hmm. things you can get from this. One, he probably just doesn't like the girl.
Mm-hmm.
Two, he might not think you're ready to get married yet, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you said both of these, right?
Yeah.
But now realize if he says no right off the bat, what's your opinion on it then? How do you take it?
Take your chance.
No, as in you go completely, either you, right? So there's two forms of this. You either just listen to them and you just destroy that option you had, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's one.
Yeah.
Right? The other one is like, oh, man. Forget what you're saying. I'm going to do what I want to do, right? You go complete rebel on it.
That's why I mentioned a point before. When you're silent, it means that it doesn't have extreme consequences.
Mm.
It doesn't lead to extreme consequences.
That's what I'm saying here.
Even if it's on any side, whether it be yes or no, it doesn't have extreme consequences.
That's true.
Like, even if you get married this time, not a big deal. There won't be any harsh consequences.
Mm.
Even if you don't get married, there won't be any harsh consequences. That's the thing, right? So I would like to add the one thing to that where we say, like, silence gives you consent and it also gives you confusion.
Okay, that's understandable. With no answer at
all,
you're kind of stuck between two paths. Okay, dear listeners, that concludes our talk today about silence and when we should be silent and when we shouldn't. And tune in next time from IRIB English Radio Youth Station. We bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I am what I am because you made. I have what I have. My love is strong because of you. Weakness.
In the limelight.
Former White House Press Secretary Stephanie Grisham said on Thursday that former President Donald Trump watched the Capitol riot unfold gleefully on 6th of January, proudly rewinding footage of the insurrection on his television. The article you're about to hear has been written by journalist John Skolnick and has been published by the website alternet.org. The piece is titled, Trump's former spokesperson says that he was gleefully rewinding Capitol riot footage on 6th of January. Stay with us for more. Former White House Press Secretary Stephanie Grisham said on Thursday that former President Donald Trump watched the Capitol riot unfold gleefully on 6th of January, proudly rewinding footage of the insurrection on his television. All I know about that day was that he was in the dining room, gleefully watching on his television, as he often did, look at all of the people fighting for me, hitting rewind, watching it again. That's what I know, Stephanie Grisham told CNN's New Day program. Her remarks, made on the anniversary of the riot, aligned with past reports about Donald Trump apparently glued to the television screen as the riot played out. Last year, Washington Post reporter Carol Lenig said in a CNN interview that the president was in the dining room of the Oval Office during the insurrection, watching it and almost giddy. But Trump's glee was reportedly not unanimous amongst his inner circle, according to recent findings by the House committee charged with investigating the insurrection. Over the past several weeks, the panel unearthed a trove of text messages from numerous Trump allies, including Fox News hosts and members of his own family, pleading with former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows to have the president call off the insurgency. He's got to condemn this as soon as possible. The Capitol Police tweet is not enough, Donald Trump's son, Donald Jr., texted Mark Meadows at the time. Donald Trump's son, Don Jr., went on to add, "We need an Oval Office address. He has to leave now. It has gone too far and gotten out of hand." On Wednesday, 5th of January 2022, Stephanie Grisham, who resigned immediately after the riot, met with the January 6th panel to discuss Donald Trump's complicity in the riot, telling reporters that she fully cooperated with the panel's questioning. The meeting was in large part set up by the Select Committee member, Representative Jamie Raskin, a Democrat from Maryland, who reportedly privately called Stephanie Grisham and encouraged her to meet with the committee, according to CNN. Grisham said that the committee was specially interested in the White House's internal activities during the insurrection. On Thursday, 6th of January 2022, Stephanie Grisham said that more than a dozen ex-Trump confidants are planning to stage an intervention with the former president. Next week, a group of former Trump staff are going to come together, administration officials are going to come together, and we're going to talk about how we can formally do some things to try and stop him, and also the extremism. That kind of violence, rhetoric that has been talked about and continues to divide our country, Stephanie Grisham told CNN's New Day. Stephanie Grisham said that about 15 of her former colleagues are involved in the scheme, some of whom have already had informal chats about it, according to CNN. Among them include White House Communications Director Anthony Scaramucci, Miles Taylor, a former top Department of Homeland Security official, and Olivia Troy, an ex-advisor to former Vice President Mike Pence. Meanwhile, Select Committee member Representative Jamie Raskin, a Democrat from Maryland, has promised that the American people will be stunned when the House Select Committee on the attack delivers its report. America is going to be shocked and surprised at what we all come to learn this year, Congressman Jamie Raskin told CNN on Thursday night, 6th of January 2022, exactly 1 year after the violent and deadly insurrection at the Capitol. He also said that Stephanie Grisham gave him a lot of names I had not heard before and identified some lines of inquiry that had never occurred to me prior to her Wednesday interview with the committee. Separately, Stephanie Grisham on Thursday revealed she and more than a dozen of other former Trump officials are meeting next week to discuss how to stop the former President Donald Trump from succeeding in his attempt to destroy democracy and to get re-elected.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Humanity is in need of Jesus Christ's teachings against oppression. Jesus Christ was equipped with the power of performing miracles and carried a divine message for humanity which saved them from the darkness of polytheism, atheism, ignorance, and oppression and guided them towards justice, knowledge, and worshipping God. And this is the lesson which all Christians and Muslims who believe in the prophethood of Jesus Christ should learn. Today, humanity is in need of those teachings more than ever before. The Virgin Mary was a young woman who stood firm against the accusations and suspicions of the people in her town and region, and she returned to her people holding her son in her arms. A girl came to a temple and stayed there until her youth. What factors and motivations caused her to resist all those temptations with such superhuman power? If her power was not superhuman, the issue would not be so greatly emphasized in the Holy Quran. The Holy Quran says she guarded her chastity, which means that she remained pure.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Islam taught us to behave in a fair way towards the followers of other religions. January 26, 2015. We have learned from Islam that we should behave in a fair way towards the followers of other religions. This is Islam's command to us. Today, what is witnessed in the world is that powers of those governments which claim to support justice do not at all behave in a fair way, except in the inner circle of their narrow, limited, and oppressive policies. Today you can see that in Europe and America, they use massive propaganda against Muslims. The issue is not why Muslims do not have any freedom in many of these countries. Rather, the issue is why they do not have any security. The movie American Sniper, which has produced some reactions and which has been made by Hollywood, encourages a Christian or non-Muslim to harass Muslims as much as he can. In fact, according to what others have said, we have not seen this movie, it encourages such courses of action. This is not at all accepted by Islam. Islam believes in justice. On the issue of that attack on the city of Al-Anbar, the commander of the faithful, peace and greetings be upon him, said, "I have come to know that every one of them entered upon Muslim women and non-Muslim women." In this sermon, he says that some people have entered the houses of Muslims and Mu'ahida women. Mu'ahid means Jewish and Christian individuals who have formed an alliance with Muslims and who live under the protection of Islam. To take away their ornaments and harass them, then Imam Ali alayhi salam said, "If any Muslim dies of grief after hearing all of this, he is not to be blamed." If a Muslim dies of grief at the harassment of non-Muslim women by the armies of the enemies and looters, they entered their houses and took away their ornaments, he is not to be blamed. This is the viewpoint of Islam.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Britain's highest rank for chivalry, awarded by Queen Elizabeth to former Prime Minister Tony Blair, a man described by campaigners as one of the most repugnant political figures in the world, in power from 1997 to 2007.
The backlash to the announcement has been immense and is only growing. Furious Iraq War veterans are now calling for the honor system to be overhauled. And more than 500,000 people have signed a petition calling on the Queen to strip the man they call a war criminal of his new title.
It's a designation routinely awarded to former prime ministers here, but anti-war campaigners say they're repulsed at seeing Blair receiving it. And they have their reasons.
For millions of people in this country, it's an absolute insult, as it is to the people of Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, and various other places where we've now seen the war on terror over the last 20 years. And I don't see any justification for it whatsoever. I think that Blair never conceded that he was wrong about any of these things. The Chilcot inquiry, which was very, very critical of him, he immediately held a very long press conference afterwards and said he would do exactly the same again.
In mid-February 2003, just before the Iraq invasion, tens of millions of demonstrators in hundreds of cities across the world, including in London, marched against the impending U.S.-led war in the Middle East. To Tony Blair, the biggest protest march in British history was fatuous.
The fact is that had we been listened to and had Britain not taken part in the war almost certainly would not have taken place, that America would have been much less likely to go to war alone, and we would have seen a much different world today, a day where far more people would be alive as a result of that war not happening, would be far fewer refugees.
The U.S. claimed the regime of former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction and actively pressed for invading Iraq in late 2001. The weapons were never found. 2 decades on, 1 million Iraqis dead, 3 million dispossessed, and a region reeling from terrorism and instability. Hundreds of British troops were also killed in the same conflict. Anti-war campaigners say Tony Blair belongs in the dock at The Hague, and not in the pantheon of great leaders. Saeed Purizap, London.
Cleared of criminal damage charges at Bristol Crown Court, Rhiann Graham, Myla Ponsford, Jake Scoos, and Sage Willoughby, dubbed the Colston Four, celebrated their acquittal in a trial that's divided British public opinion. For those who had been on trial, relief and a sense of vindication.
We are ecstatic and stunned. I tried to write something ready for this moment, and I'm just so overwhelmed.
We didn't change history, we rectified history.
We illuminated history. Daylight, we illuminated history.
And this is the victory for Bristol. This is the victory for racial equality.
And this is where it began, at a Black Lives Matter demonstration in Bristol in June 2020.
I think the court accepted that this was almost a political show trial, that Boris Johnson and the Home Secretary, Priti Patel, had determined that they wanted to make an example of the Colston Four, and the courts rejected that.
The jury's verdict has garnered mixed reviews, with some MPs writing to the Attorney General, asking him to look once more at the wrong result. Elsewhere, there have been calls for the Home Secretary to explain why this case was so heavily pursued in the first place, and what happens now when that move has seemingly backfired.
The focus is now on high-profile monuments like the statue of Sir Winston Churchill, Britain's lauded World War II leader, but a figure that's being seen increasingly through the lens of his controversial views on race and empire.
New legislation being pushed through under the Police and Crime Bill will make defacing monuments punishable by up to 10 years behind bars.
Women watchers to your station will be surprised to know you can get longer for pulling down a statue under the new provisions than you do for rape, which is absolutely bizarre. But it shows the extent to which this government is intent on pursuing culture wars and criminalising the Black Lives Matter movement.
There is the hope that many local and national stakeholders will use the outcome of the Colston Four trial as a teachable moment, a chance to reflect on Britain's chequered past. But then again, maybe it will just be business as usual. Amina Taylor, London.
Thank you.
Hisham Abu Hawash has been refusing to eat for 141 days. But he's finally breaking his fast because the Israeli regime has agreed to release him next month. Abu Hawash has been receiving a great deal of support from the Palestinian people, who have rallied, protesting his unjust detention and demanding his freedom. And now these people finally have a reason to celebrate. In Al-Khalil, Abu Hawash's home, his supporters have turned out to rejoice this victory against Israeli jailers. His family had especially a tough time in recent days after doctors warned that Abu Hawash's health was deteriorating, that he was slipping in and out of coma and facing the danger of sudden death. Now they can finally breathe a sigh of relief.
I thank all the Palestinians who stood with us. Thanks to everyone who helped my brother. I thank God they released him.
During the past 3 days, we lived through a psychological war that was carried out by the Israeli intelligence due to what was happening with my brother Hisham. There were strong maneuvers, but we overpassed those as a family. Today, Hisham achieved victory for all the Palestinians.
Now, Abu Hawash's lawyer says he would be hospitalized for medical follow-up before his designated release on February 26. Palestinian officials have weighed in, praising his resistance.
Hisham Abu Hawash prevails after 141 days of hunger strike. We hail Hisham for his forceful will, his family, Palestinian people, and people around the world who raise their voices in solidarity. Thanks to countries that press Israel to release him next month on February 26.
Resistance movements have also poured praise on Abu Hawash, saying his victory should remind Palestinians how they can win every battle against Israel. The 40-year-old father of five children was arrested in October 2020 and started his hunger strike early 5 months ago to protest his detention without charge or trial that is allowed under Israel's administrative detention system. His lengthy hunger strike once again shed light on this illegal practice. Out of 7,000 Palestinians in Israeli jails, more than 500 are locked up without facing any charges or having a trial. For many of them, the last choice against this inhumane measure is to stop eating for lengthy periods of time. Still, the majority find themselves locked up in deplorable and non-standard conditions of the Israeli prisons, where they are sometimes even subjected to systematic torture and harassment.
In late 2020, Americans went to the ballots to pick the country's next president. 4 days after votes closed, Joe Biden was declared the winner. But the incumbent leader, Donald Trump, alleged vote fraud, and in doing so, shattered Washington's self-proclaimed image of the cradle of democracy. Trump adamantly refused to concede defeat after losing the 2020 presidential vote. On January 6, 2021, he called on his supporters to march on the Capitol and, quote, stop the steal. His fans attempted to do that. The world was shocked as news networks around the world showed thousands of Trump supporters forcing their way into the Capitol building, the symbol of U.S. democracy. Lawmakers engaged in the process of certifying the presidential election had to stop their task and flee for their lives. Some reports even suggest that a Republican senator was so frightened that he asked the Capitol security repeatedly to shoot the protesters. 5 people died in the chaos, one of them in the Congress building. To date, American authorities have arrested nearly 600 people and are looking for hundreds of more suspects. A big portion of the defendants stand accused of assaulting police officers. The FBI asked U.S. citizens to report each other out and tell the police if they knew anyone who had taken part in the riots. The incident inevitably had adverse consequences for the United States' image, both domestically and internationally. An opinion poll conducted last year by Harvard University showed that more than half of the country's young generation thought that American democracy is in trouble or failing. Moreover, an Axios survey indicated that now only 51% of the U.S. public thinks the next presidential election will be fair and free. Also, the Democracy Perception Index for 2021 showed that 44% of participants perceive the U.S. influence and meddling in the affairs of their countries as the biggest threat to democracy in their nations. At the same time, politicians and political analysts express shock and disgust at the chaotic scenes at the Congress grounds. Richard N. Haas, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, said the attack signaled a post-American era. The assault on the Capitol changed the face of Washington, D.C. as well. The Congress building was fenced off on multiple occasions after the riots. Furthermore, Joe Biden's inauguration was carried out under heavy military presence, with an unprecedented 25,000 troops ensuring security. That was bigger than the number of U.S. forces present in Iraq and Afghanistan on the same day. The police reaction to the Capitol riots also raised questions about the U.S. law enforcement's differential treatment of white protesters. Whereas black people could be killed and injured for much smaller crimes, police were in fact criticized for their late and subdued response to the deadly protests by Trump's supporters.
Representatives of resistance groups gathered in Beirut to pay tribute to Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. The two anti-terror icons were assassinated in an American drone strike outside Baghdad airport on January 3, 2020. Participants in the event all agreed that Soleimani united the region in the face of a common threat posed by the U.S. and Israel.
Their martyrdom did not weaken the resistance. On the contrary, it led to more accomplishments and success for the resistance. They are alive. This type of life is what gives a strength to the resistance. Martyr Qasem transcended his country to become the martyr of the entire nation, and this is an exceptional characteristic.
Hezbollah Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qasem stressed that people in the region will stand united and confront the threat posed by the United States. Meanwhile, the Secretary General of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad Movement, Ziad Nakhala, described Soleimani as the martyr of Palestine and Al-Quds.
The U.S. assassinated Soleimani because he was a barrier to American Israeli plots in the region. He transformed the resistance fighters into a strategic threat to Israel and the U.S. I take this opportunity to say that we're proud of the positions of the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is unwavering in its support for the Palestinian resistance, and I witnessed that Qasem Soleimani was at the forefront of the fight in defense of Palestine and the people of Palestine.
The Iranian ambassador to Beirut also said that there is a joint Iranian-Iraqi judicial lawsuit being followed up by both countries to try the killers of the Iranian and Iraqi martyrs who were assassinated by the United States. Resistance groups in the region consider General Qasem Soleimani as a man and a leader who united them. People in Lebanon, even those who knew him only after his martyrdom, see him as a man who transcended borders and sacrificed his life for the sake of the people and regional peace and stability. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
This international conference is the gathering of Islamic scholars converged in the port city of Karachi against Islamophobia. They believe Islamophobia is a Western project to reshape Islam with tools like Daesh and others.
Participants of the conference stress on the need of unity among Muslims and call on the Islamic countries to take serious notice of the forces hell-bent to sow seed of discords among Muslim Ummah.
Documentary films during the past years over the gruesome acts of Daesh in the name of Islam were played to remind people how terrorist groups were weaponized by Israel and the U.S. to distort the face of Islam in the West.
Actually, Islamophobia is a project of Western country who do not like the Western people come to Islam, like Islam. And they mention